You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of October 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
I'm a young politician, but being a young politician does not make me forget our own history.
Austria prepares to welcome to office its 31-year-old Chancellor, but how worried should we be about who is coming with him? My guests Brian Klass and Mari Bion will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including another demonstration via the weekend's truck bomb in Mogadishu of our selective attention to terrorist atrocities, the latest attempt to dislodge the manifold blockages to Brexit, and why didn't the media go after Harvey Weinstein sooner? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to the show. My guests today are Mari Bion, UK correspondent for French media, and Brian Klass, fellow in comparative politics at the LSE and author of The Imminent, The Despot's Apprentice, Donald Trump's Attack on Democracy. Welcome both. We will start in Austria and the possibility that the sigh of relief exhaled last year when the far-right Freedom Party's Norbert Hofer narrowly failed to become president may have to be inhaled. In yesterday's parliamentary election in Austria, the Freedom Party did dishearteningly well. They appear to have finished in third place and may well play a role in Austria's new government, which now seems almost certain to be led by Sebastian Kurz, the 31-year-old leader of the centre-right People's Party. Mari, first of all, we saw quite a lot of people exhaling a similar sigh of relief over the election in your homeland, while I think there was a kind of a global forgetting that still a great many French people did vote for a far-right crank. Quite a lot of Austrians appear to have now done the same. How big a concern is this?
Well, it is a general trend in Europe and even further outside Europe, this rightization of the politics. So it's something that should be worried. It's also something that we shouldn't cover our eyes against. I think in Austria, when there was this coalition with this far-right party in the early 2000s, there were Europe imposed sanction on Austria because of that. Now there's no talk about sanction because it's important not to just, you know, veil your face and forget about the rightization of the political landscape today. It's important to face it head on, to understand why people are more interested into this right-leaning politics, and to understand, very importantly, if it's really useful or intelligent from the centre-right and centre-left party to try and borrow themes to this right-leaning parties. Is it really important that this area are covered by people who are less extreme but still listen to the concern of the population, or should we tackle the problem the other way around? And that's something that the Austrian election campaign showed, because the left borrowed a few themes to the right parties. In France, it didn't happen a lot. It happened during Sarkozy, so that was 8 years ago. It worked for him, he was elected, but 4 years later it didn't work for him, he was not elected, and the left took power. So it's a very interesting topic, understanding if those themes are really interested, the people are really interested into those themes, or if they are more interested into the party in itself, the ideology of the parties.
I was just being yelled at there by our producer that you are in fact from Monaco, not France. Profuse apologies. But you do cover France, so I think I was about a fifth right, Tom. Brian, Kurz now does have to assemble a coalition. Can he responsibly bring the Freedom Party into government, even if it's what he needs to do to form a government?
Well, this is where I think there is an opportunity for him to do something really right here, which is to draw a line between the legitimate debate about immigration in Europe and in the United States and in every country in the West, and the illegitimate debate that ends up being completely racist. And I think there's a change in what's called the Overton window of what's politically acceptable to say. And that window has opened considerably, right? And so you have this movement where, for example, in the United States, there's a Senate candidate for the Republican Party in Alabama who's getting endorsed by the mainstream Republicans,
Roy Moore,
who has said that Muslims should not be allowed to be in Congress. He was disbarred from the bench because he did not respect rule of law. These shouldn't be partisan issues. They should be outside what's acceptable in politics. Whereas somebody saying, I think we need to curb immigration is not, right? And so if Kurtz wants to do this responsibly, he needs to say, okay, we're going to bring in the Freedom Party, but we're going to have very clear dividing lines about how this immigration debate will unfold. And it is totally acceptable to talk about numbers and to talk about cultural identity and to talk about assimilation and debates that democratic politics are supposed to have. And it's not acceptable to bring in some of the ugly past with people from the Freedom Party who, you know, I mean, is founded by an SS officer. The current president was a neo-Nazi in his youth. And those people have unsavory views that are not acceptable within democratic politics. So I think, you know, this is where the line has to be drawn. But I think there's a bigger debate happening right now that I've seen across the Atlantic and in Europe, where you see the internationalization of these radical ideas. And one just quick anecdote was last year, sort of like March or so of 2016, when I was talking in the media against Republicans in American politics, you would have, you know, candidates who would absolutely say, we accept Muslims, right? That this is something that's part of our culture. It's part of American, you know, there's no religious tests. And then you have Donald Trump come in and you want to have this media debate be even-handed. So all of a sudden the debate becomes, should we ban Muslims, right? And that's now internationalized because that's happening in British media every time Trump gets discussed. It's happening in Austria media every time now they talk about the Freedom Party. So these ideas that used to be fringe, that used to be sanctionable offenses are now mainstream. And that means that it's going to germinate similar movements into the mainstream elsewhere in Europe.
Murray, there is, of course, the obvious aspect, or the headline aspect of Sebastian Kurz's biography, and I'll ask you both what you think about this, and that he is extremely young. He is 31, and obviously, though, we have seen, for example, in France, a president elected who was not yet 40 when elected. Is that too young?
I guess it all depends on the person. I mean, you can see a 70-plus-year-old elected somewhere across the pond and it's not very competent. Is Macron... Well, I do think he's perhaps not very competent, but Emmanuel Macron might seem more competent than he is to some people, although on the day-to-day, on the nitty-gritty of things, he's had a few missteps that he did because he didn't have any experience in politics. So that's the very difference. Emmanuel Macron didn't have a lot of experience in politics, whereas as young as he is, Kurtz has experience in politics, a few years of experience in politics. So he might be young, but he has experience. So I think we have to give him the benefit of the doubt. And what's important for young people when they want to vote for younger politicians is that they have this idea that younger people are less, part of the establishment, that they still have some kind of ideal that they want to put forwards. Of course, it's a bit more complicated to explain when it's someone from the right, but that's something that's very important for young people when they look at their young leaders. Is it something that's sustainable, though? Because we all hear, of course, the older generation saying, well, you're left when you're young and you're going to be right when you're older. And we can see with this young man, and he's very, very much, not just on the right, but very much on the right-hand side. So there's a complete shift in Europe about how young people are supposed to have the view word of the young people. So I think it's too simplistic to ask, is he too young? Because being young now, compared and in terms of our political views, is so very different from a few years ago.
Brian, of course, in the United States, he would be constitutionally ineligible to become head of state, head of government for another 4 years. Is that kind of... I mean, you know, the present incumbent, I guess, as Murray suggested, is a fairly compelling argument that there should be an upper limit. But should there be a lower one?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. So in the U.S., it's 25 to be in the House of Representatives, 30 to be a senator, and 35 to be president or vice president. So, and what's even more interesting about that was at a time when life expectancy was significantly lower, right? I mean, so these were people that were more, you know, after you're 35, you're probably at least two-thirds done with your life back in the 1700s. So, yeah, I mean, it's part of American culture, but I think the debate in the U.S. is much more about the upper limit now because people like Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden are talked about in Democratic circles for possible 2020 challenges to Trump, and they'll be in their late 70s.
Trump is already, I think I'm right in saying, the oldest sworn in for the first time, isn't
he? Yeah, and he's 71. So, he would be in his late 70s if he were to make it to a second term.
The rest of us would just feel like we were in our late 70s.
But I mean, you know, I think there is a point to be made here about experience, because you do have somebody who's 71 who's never served in any elected office. Is he really better qualified than somebody who has spent most of their, you know, post 18-year-old life in actual political life? I'm not so convinced. Of course, I'm biased because I am under 35.
Well, let's take a look now at Somalia, where the death toll from Saturday's truck bomb in Mogadishu is now known to have reached at least 320, with hundreds more injured. It is without doubt one of the worst terrorist attacks in recent history anywhere in the world, but it is difficult to avoid noticing that it is attracting less attention and sympathy and sentimental hashtags than a great many others. The observation that some casualties are more newsworthy than others is not a new one, but is it just down to the fact that it's easier to report from Paris or London? Or is there something else going on? See, Murray, I do wonder about this. It is a common response that, you know, the idea that the Western media values deaths in London or Paris or Manchester or New York more than it does deaths in identical circumstances in Mogadishu. And I think there's something to that, but is there a non-sinister answer at all? Is it just that it's much easier to report a story from London or Paris or New York than it is from somewhere like Mogadishu?
If it was somewhere else in Somalia, somewhere further away from Mogadishu, yes, that could be, I guess, an argument. But Mogadishu, I'm sure there's a lot of people who are based there, correspondents who are based there. Even if it's not your normal correspondent, you certainly have some kind of someone on the spot that can, do a few funners for you to let you know about the evolving situation. So, and afterwards, you might send someone who might do the report. But I don't think that's really a good answer to say we don't have people. We perhaps have less possibility to report on that, but we still have the possibility. I guess all the major media outlets have the possibility to report on that. There's kind of a decision of an interest. It's mainly, even when I report things that happening into the UK to France, the first thing I've been asked is, where is it, a big city? Is it a city that's known? And are there any deaths? That's something that's quite important. If that's something where there's no death but it's far away, even if it's spectacular, it's not going to be interesting. If there are deaths, it is interesting. In this case, there's a lot of deaths, and still, it's not too interesting. And I wouldn't want to speculate on the reason why. The fact that it's far away, it does mean something. I mean, even if something happened in Iceland, I'm not sure we would cover it as much as it happened in Manchester.
I wonder about that as well, Brian, because it was a useful corrective to me, I think. I happened to be, years ago, obviously almost exactly 16 years ago, I was working on a story in China not long after September 11th, and I think I flew from London to Beijing about a week and a half later, not long after airports were getting back into gear. And obviously I'd had a week and a half of watching the news in London and just, oh my God, world to end tomorrow, this is literally the worst thing ever. And then in China, it was a story, but people were just, And then it occurred to me that if there'd been something of that scale had happened in Beijing or Shanghai, it would obviously have been covered in the Western media, but it wouldn't have been anywhere like as big a deal. Is it just that? I mean, this is probably, I'm assuming here, being reported in much greater style in Ethiopia, Kenya, and Somalia than it is here.
Yeah, so I think there's several things going on at the same time, and both sides of this are a bit extreme. So I think it's absolutely certain that lives in Africa are not given the same worth in media attention as lives in the West. But at the same time, I think there are some reasons for this. One is regularity, right? So why don't we hear Syria casualties front page news every single day? Thousands of people have died in weeks, right? I mean, over 1 week, you might have 2,000, 3,000 deaths. It's not front page news because it becomes routine. And people see Somalia as a place where this happens routinely. So that starts to become a reason why the media doesn't report it as much. Another reason for this is, of course, that there is something that people like Benedict Anderson have called imagined communities, where you believe that you're part of a certain community, and it's a cultural identity, right? And so even like in my home state of Minnesota, we report, the local newspapers report much more in detail about people who die from Minnesota than people who die from Wisconsin 30 miles away, right? Because they believe it's a hometown community. And so you have that to a slightly larger, you know, concentric circles with London. And then the third thing that London or Paris or whatever. And the third thing that I think is happening is people like news that they believe could affect them. So you don't see reports of, for example, Chicago gangland violence nearly as much in the United States, because a lot of people who tend to be white in the media and the people consuming news who tend to be white feel that they would not be affected by that situation. But in Las Vegas, they certainly could be. right? Because they think, oh, I might go as a tourist to Vegas and have a mass shooting, whereas I might not end up in a really poor part of the South Side of Chicago. Now, these are all terrible things, right? Because they're denigrating the value of human life based on subjective circumstances. But I think that's part of why it's happening, in addition to the very ugly truth that Africans are just given less worth in Western press.
Now, since the New York Times and the New Yorker broke the Harvey Weinstein scandal last week, there has been much self-congratulation among the media at large that it was proper old-fashioned journalism that uncovered what appears to have been decades of thoroughly monstrous behaviour. The question thus begged, of course, is why proper old-fashioned journalism did not do so rather earlier, potentially sparing any number of victims of Weinstein's advances, especially given the growing numbers of people claiming that everybody knew all along. Murray, is there a good reason, as far as we can tell, why organizations like the Times, like the New Yorker, serious media outlets with proper resources, didn't turn this guy over 20, 30 years ago?
A good reason, I'm not sure that can be put that way, but there are lots of reasons why it didn't happen. I'm not sure they I wouldn't speculate on the fact they are good or bad. I do think that there are a few reasons why it wasn't reported before. The first thing is that, as the journalist who did the investigation explains, it took her 4 months to basically just publish something. And even if the New York Times, of course, has money, it's costing a lot of time to journalists, and so it's costing a lot of money to the New York Times for just a few words printed, although of course it snowballs very quickly, but it takes a lot of time. Whereas if you want to do a normal story on something happening in Hollywood, it can take you half a day to do that and to write it. And that's, of course, that's something that's quite important. You have to manage your resources when you're a newspaper. And now with Trump, there's a new ideal to journalism. Is so much attacked by journalism is so much attacked by Trump that people are now defending journalists and the media and their role and their very chivalric role. So they now have, I think, have this shift in the newsroom, thinking, well, now we have some credit to the population. We can show that what journalism is about. And journalism is about not just doing a half a day story. It's about going into a very thorough investigation. And that's why I think it's happening now and not 2 years ago.
Is it possible, Brian, and Mari there raises the spectre of Trump, that Trump's presence in the White House, despite what we know about Trump and what we know about Trump because he said it himself, has made people think about this sort of stuff a little more? I mean, we have to address, or at least acknowledge, the fact that nearly 64 million Americans thought that cheerfully confessing to serial sexual assault was no barrier whatsoever to holding public office. But is it possible that Trump inadvertently, and he has done a lot of things inadvertently, may have raised a certain amount of consciousness about how common and how pervasive this kind of thing is?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a tipping point, and it may have been ushered in by the horror that many people felt at watching somebody brag about sexual assault and then subsequently become the most powerful person on the planet. But I think, this is a story that has systemic power relations looking very ugly on multiple levels, both in the media and in Hollywood, right? And the idea that power over an individual's career is sufficient to silence what could be hundreds or thousands of people, including people in the Weinstein company who knew what was happening and were actually involved in organizing these salacious meets and facilitating them without speaking out. Now, the media also has to do some introspection on the fact that Weinstein, I mean, was known very well as somebody who destroyed other people's careers through the press. So one of the things that he actually did, that where this intersects with the media in a very interesting and disgusting way, is he would basically say to people, if they didn't do what he said, I will destroy you publicly, and I will use my context in the media to do so. And you see this in some of the coverage that we, in Italy and places like that, of this story, where it's much more about the victims than about Weinstein. So, I think that there's a reckoning that has to be, brought to the forefront, that not only is Weinstein just the tip of the iceberg, but he's also, it's the story's less about him and more about how this is common, and that there are systemic abuses of power in many places that involve sexual harassment and assault. And hopefully this will be a turning point where the media has actually, you know, done a little bit to make up for the fact that they may have been complicit in covering this up previously.
Mari, Brian there mentioned the Italian coverage in particular, which has in its own way attracted a certain amount of coverage of its own, which has been extremely weird in that it has gone about suggesting that the victims of Weinstein's alleged crimes were somehow complicit in them, which is... one would think the obvious doesn't need to be stated about this, but apparently it does. Have you been surprised by how much of that there has been? And it hasn't just been in the Italian media. What a really common response is, because so many women now have spoken up, not just about Weinstein, but about other similar creatures as well. And there's been a common response of, well, you should have said something earlier, by people who fail to understand that probably the reason they didn't was the fear that they wouldn't be believed by the kind of people who would say, well, you should have said something earlier.
Well, there's the idea that one person talking is an opportunity for someone else to talk to say about the same thing. And is the second person talking as honest as the first one and the third one and consecutively so? It's a question that, I mean, has to be asked, because, of course, it's not. It's really when one person is talking, it's really snowballing. And you could ask the question why those third, fourth, fifth person didn't talk first and ask themselves if they are, and ask if they are very genuine. But of course, it doesn't take a lot of looking into to realize that the reason why people are talking now is because one had the strength to do it and was not taken down by all the media, by some maybe, but most of them were quite supportive. So they've been heard, and now there's the power of Twitter. And I think a lot of people would basically go to Twitter to back the actress who would talk, saying it happened to me, I'm with you, although I might not like your work, but I support you. That's something that didn't happen 5, 6, 10 years ago, and I think that's very important.
You can reach a community much more quickly now and feel like you're not alone, I guess.
Yes, and it's not just the actress who are talking. I mean, the actresses are also prompting the general public to talk about their abusers as well. So it's not just about, you know, the rich and famous. It's about the rich and famous talking because they have a platform, and the non-rich and famous have this other platform, which is Twitter, by which they talk about themselves, but they also support the people who have this platform. So there's kind of a virtuous circle that's happening now. And of course, there can be enraging a few people in the media, because it's still predominantly white and still predominantly men, in particular in Italy. So of course they want to stick together. That's a normal way of doing things. And of course it's a southern Europe country, so there's another culture, perhaps a more machistic culture in Italy. And I'm not surprised that it happened in Italy. I mean, this kind of coverage could not have happened, I guess, in Stockholm or something like that. It happened in Italy for a reason. And of course they had the Berlusconi stories and all that, so they're quite used to these kind of things. So I think it's not surprising it happened in Italy. It's surprising it's happening still today.
Okay, well, finally tonight, if you are listening to this before attending some engagement that you would rather chew off your own arms than endure, spare a thought for UK Prime Minister Theresa May, who is in Brussels for a private dinner with European Commission Chief Jean-Claude Juncker and Chief Brexit Negotiator Michel Barnier. The alleged aim is to end the present stalemate over Brexit talks. In a discouraging choice of simile, Mr. Juncker said details of the deliberations would be revealed in a subsequent, quote, autopsy. Brian, how much fun do you imagine this is going to be for everybody?
Oh goodness, this is this is going to be a disaster probably, but it's one that, you know, everyone is hoping to come away from this simultaneously with progress and with something to show for their constituencies, right? I mean, this is one of the problems with the debate, is that it's happening, a negotiation is happening in a very visible way, right? And all the different constituencies have different moving parts. And, you know, it's another clear indication of how weak the British government's position is in this debate, is that they know the clock is ticking. There are people saying we need to prepare for no deal. Virtually everybody except for further right people in the UK understand that no deal would be a catastrophe for Britain. And Europe knows probably correctly that it has less to lose than Britain does. And so, you know, at some point, Theresa May will need to be very, very straightforward with people like Juncker and say, you know, we need to get a deal done. And this is the hard line. But it's a very, very heavy lift for Britain to come out of this with minimal economic damage. And I think that the window for that is closing consistently as these talks continue to be more about political posturing and selling a certain outcome to their constituencies than any actual given progress.
Yeah, Mari, as Brian points out, while the UK has more to lose here, the EU does have something to lose if the UK crashes out of this with no deal. But how seriously do you think the EU is taking Theresa May at this point?
Well, Theresa May herself, of course, herself is very damaged by the election and all the subsequent crises that she had to deal with. Most recently, of course, the infamous speech after better speech, of course, of Florence, which basically helped the EU to be a bit more positive. And then the other one happened, showing that she might not be around for the rest of the negotiation, or if she around for the rest of the negotiation, she'd be leaving soon. So how sustainable are negotiations with her? Is a question. Of course she's going tonight, and it's a story in itself that she's going tonight because she's not the one doing the negotiations. It's David Davis doing the negotiations.
I believe he is also attending.
Yes, but I mean she's not around the round table all the 3 days of the negotiation that happens every month. It's not her being there on the table. Tonight it is her. That's why it is a story. But it's not her that the Europeans are negotiating with. It's with her team. And in a way, the fact that it's not her makes it more easy because David Davis, there's no talk about housing David Davis at the Brexit as the Brexit minister, or perhaps to make him prime minister. So he's a more sustainable person to talk to for the EU. The fact that Theresa May is going down there tonight, I think. I've been tempted to say that the European will have a field day as well, just like they did last time when Juncker went out of Downing Street after the dinner and he said what he said and the sources said what they said. I think they have a tremendous fun to do that because the UK, not being very constructive in itself, they wanted in a way to show how not constructive they can be as well. So the temptation will be to do the same now, although EU as well as the UK now think that it's time to become serious. So I'm curious to see how it's going to be reported on tomorrow.
Brian, very quick final thought. Is there any way at this point that Theresa May can arrest the gathering narrative that this is all rather degenerating into shambles?
No, and I think, you know, one of the reasons for this is that we have a very peculiar situation on both sides of the Atlantic now, where the people in the government do not believe in the policies that they are trying to enact, right? I mean, in the Republican Party, most people find Trump to be a menace. Privately, they will say the things that Bob Corker is saying publicly. In Britain, many Republicans will privately acknowledge that Brexit has a lot of downside and little upside.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. Brian Klass and Mari Beyond, thank you both very much for joining us. Today's episode of Midori House was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Daphne Carnesis. Our studio manager was David Stevens. More music next at 1900. It's Culture with Robert Bound. We'll have more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Mullett. Thanks for listening.